KPOO 89.5 FM. And today we're going to have a great show. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk to attorney Mr. Michael Deutsch, and he is the representative for Mohamed Salah. And if you're not familiar with the case of Mohamed Salah, he's an American citizen of Palestinian descent. He traveled from his home in Bridgeview, Illinois, to Israel in 1993 to provide monetary assistance to Palestinian families. At the Gaza border crossing, over 20 Israeli soldiers arrested and detained him. The Israeli Secret Service then systematically tortured him during an 80-day interrogation and forced Mr. Salah to sign a confession in Hebrew, a language that Mr. Salah does not understand. The Israeli military court sentenced him to 5 years in prison. And after serving his sentence, he returned home to his family in the U.S. in 1997. And now, first of all, Mr. Deutsch, welcome to Arab Talk.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to first just give our listeners a brief on to what happened to Mr. Salah upon his return to the United States.
Well, he, as you mentioned, he returned in 1997, reunited with his family. He has five children. He was immediately designated as a special terrorist by the United States government, which meant that he could not receive money or spend money without a special license. But nonetheless, he was struggling to support his family and was in a small business. And then after 2001, in 2004, months before the presidential election, he was indicted with a major press conference by Ashcroft, the then Attorney General, accusing him of conspiring with Hamas and providing material support to Hamas, which is based essentially on the coerced statements he gave 13 years prior in 1993. So the U.S. government was going to be trying to use evidence obtained by torture by the Israelis in a U.S. federal court to send Mr. Salah to prison for the rest of his life.
Now, Michael, isn't that go against everything that we believe in with respect to constitutionality of people's rights in the United States?
Well, absolutely. You're, first of all, coerced confessions are illegal. They cannot be used against you. Mr. Salah was interrogated for 80 days. He was denied any lawyer for 15 days. He was held incommunicado for 6 days. He was deprived of sleep for 48 hours. He was threatened. He was tied to a small chair, which is a noted practice the Israelis use, hooded, subjected to deafening noise, put in a closet-like cell for hours at a time. Basically, he was tortured for all these days, and interestingly or tragically, these types of methods were at that particular time sanctioned by the Israeli government. They actually allowed physical force and psychological force to be used to obtain confessions from Palestinians. And of course, 95% of the people who are detained by the Israeli Secret Service ultimately confess under these conditions. And Mr. Salah was one of those victims. But what is most troubling about it all is now the U.S. wants to use this tortured evidence in a federal court in Chicago.
Well, help us wrap our minds around that, Michael. Help us, our listeners, wrap our minds around the idea that the United States government is bringing charges against an American citizen based on evidence that was actually obtained under torture by a foreign government.
Well, it's hard to really understand, and originally Mr. Salah and other lawyers were told, the U.S. government will never be able to use this evidence because of the nature in which it was obtained. But unfortunately, we're in a post-2001 era here, and there are many things that are happening in the U.S. courts that you can't believe and would not have happened before then. And what the government is basically saying is, despite the fact that Israelis could use these methods, they didn't use them on Mr. Saleh because he was a U.S. citizen, even though there are legions of U.S. Palestinian U.S. citizens who have been detained and tortured, and that all of Mr. Saleh's statements were given voluntarily. They didn't put him in a small chair. They didn't hood him. They didn't threaten him. They didn't physically abuse him. And they actually brought two of these Shabak interrogators from Israel to testify against Mr. Saleh. And, of course, when they did that, they closed the courtroom, prohibited the public from being in there, prohibited the press from being in there, and they essentially had a secret proceeding where these people testified, where only the lawyers and the defendant was there. But beyond that, when we began to question them about their methods against Mr. Saleh, they said that information was classified, secret, and therefore they would only talk about that with the judge and the U.S. attorney in the back, and that Mr. Saleh and his lawyers could not be present for that. So we're not only having a torture testimony in a closed courtroom, but the specifics of it are in secret, where the defendant and his lawyers aren't able to even confront the evidence.
Doesn't this remind you of what happened in Abu Ghraib, or the stories we hear that happens in Guantanamo?
Well, it's very similar. And of course, we know that the Israelis are the most experienced in use of psychological and physical torture. We know there's been interaction between the Israelis and the U.S. security forces about how to interrogate and get information. And this is kind of a rendition, using tortured evidence now in a U.S. courtroom that was obtained by the Israelis. So, yeah, this is a continuation of what's going on now in Guantanamo and all these other secret CIA black holes all over Europe that have been used to house people that are accused of being terrorists.
So I'm not sure the listening public can truly understand the enormity and the profound implications of this, Michael, because we're talking about a parallel system of justice or a parallel system of injustice where certain people are processed, which really raises some deep, deep concerns in the civil liberties and civil rights community right now.
Absolutely, and it's happening in various parts of the country. There was a Muslim man in Virginia, Abu Ali, who was tortured by the Saudis and confessed. He even had whip marks on his back and came to the U.S., and the U.S. prosecutors used his coerced statements, and the judge refused to suppress him, finding that he didn't believe that Abu Ali was tortured, even though the Saudis have a history of it, and they admitted that you get interrogated until you confess. That's their system. You're interrogated until you confess, which is essentially the Israeli system as well. You cannot see a lawyer until you confess. You are interrogated for hours at a time. When you're not interrogated, you are said to be waiting, which is where you're tied to a small chair where you cannot sleep. A filthy, foul-smelling hood is put on your head, and any time you nod off, you're slapped awake by a soldier or an interrogator.
Mr. Deutsch, I mean, help me again. I apologize for my ignorance in our laws. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, I am just like Mr. Saleh, a Palestinian-American, and when I came to this country, I read the Constitution, you know, part of my civil duty here, and there is nowhere in the Constitution that explains or permits this method in this part of the due process. Can you explain to us what happened to the Constitution?
Well, you're right. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows for coerced confessions or confessions taken against your will. And in fact, in this country, if you're arrested, before you're interrogated, you're given what's called the Miranda warnings, which you're told that anything you say, you don't have to speak to us. Anything you say will be used against you, and you have a right to a lawyer, and if you can't afford a lawyer, we'll appoint a lawyer for you. And, of course, in Israel, they don't have that. You don't have a right to a lawyer. You don't have a right to remain silent. If you refuse to talk to the interrogator, that silence can be used as evidence against you in a trial, Or what often happens in Israel is they put you in administrative detention for refusing to cooperate. And people can be kept in there for years. One person was testified in our case, was kept in for 5 years. The reason that they're able to do this is that they come into court, and this is what they've done in Israel for years, and they say, we didn't have to use any force against Mr. Salah or somebody else. They cooperated with us willingly. We didn't have to coerce them, and therefore their statements are voluntary, and therefore we can use their statements. And, of course, what they do is they bring in these interrogators who are schooled in lying, and in fact there was an investigation of rampant systematic lying by the Secret Service of Israel in these cases, and there was a big scandal and expose, and they say that we didn't torture them. We didn't use the small chair, we didn't put the hood on, we didn't threaten them, we didn't deprive him of sleep. And then the issue becomes, who do you believe? Do you believe Mr. Salah, or do you believe these Israeli interrogators? And that's what the judge in our case has to decide. Now, we put on some of the leading human rights activists, both Palestinian and Israeli, in our hearing. Dr. Iyad Siraj, who is the executive director of the Gaza Mental Health Program, testified. Avigdor Feldman, who is an Israeli human rights lawyer who brought the case to the Israeli Supreme Court in 1999 that held that these types of treatment constituted torture and allegedly stopped this treatment. A guy by the name of Yuval Ginbar, who was with Amnesty International and was with B'Tselem, which is a leading Israeli human rights organization. And Jonathan Kitab, who is one of the leaders of El Haq, which is a Palestinian human rights organization, and a leading lawyer in the occupied territories and in Israel. And all these people explain to the judge that there's a systematic policy of torture by the Israelis. And everybody gets tortured, and everybody confesses, and this is how you do it, and this is how you break the will. Now the question is, the Israeli interrogators say, no, we didn't do that, we didn't have to do it, the person cooperated. And the real issue is whether the judge is going to enforce the Constitution and believe those human rights activists and Mr. Salah, or side with the Israelis. And it really comes down to that question. Now, if the judge refuses to rule in our favor and allows these confessions to come in, we still can raise these issues at trial with a jury who's going to be, you know, maybe less prejudiced than a judge who, you know, is influenced by a lot of other things that a jury might not be influenced by.
Let me just also remind our listeners that the overwhelming research does show that any kind of statements or admissions under torture are routinely and systematically found to be not worthwhile or not representative of anything having to do with reality. And then the second thing, obtaining evidence under torture is not admissible also. So these are really gross violations. So, Michael, can you put this in the larger context? How does it relate to the Patriot Act, and how does it relate to other things that are happening right now regards to these abuses of civil liberties in the United States?
The problem. First of all, we're concerned about what they call rendition, where the U.S. takes people who they arrest and they send them to a foreign government for interrogation. And in fact, they've been doing that. They sent a person to Syria. We know they sent them to other places, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. And if these countries routinely torture detainees. And if the U.S. government can then get evidence that a foreign government gets by torture and use that in a federal courtroom, basically we're circumventing international human rights covenants against torture, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, the 14th Amendment due process, and it really kind of opens the door to a slippery slope, if you will, to allow this type of abuse to be used in a U.S. courtroom, which it's never been allowed to use before. We don't allow evidence obtained by torture to be used in our courts. And now you're seeing the beginning of argument, but we have to get the information. Of course, the Israelis have always said there's a ticking time bomb exception. They always say that we have to use torture because, you know, to prevent greater harm. And now we're seeing these kinds of arguments being raised in U.S. courts about the need to maybe use torture because to prevent a greater harm, we should be able to. You even have federal judges and law professors like Alan Dershowitz and a United States Court of Appeals judge in Chicago, Richard Posner, who's very well-read and well-respected, writing articles saying that, yes, torture should be available to the U.S. government in certain circumstances and be admitted in the U.S. courtroom.
Well, obviously, I mean, Mr. Salah was not a ticking bomb, you know. I mean, from what I read here, they were talking about making financial contributions, so I don't think that ticking bomb rule applies. But also, at the same time, I want to ask you, just for our listeners, what type of evidence did the Israelis, besides the testimonials of their torturers, their henchmen, who are the Shabak, basically, you know, when you send somebody that works for the Shabak, those are the ones that beat up on the people with, you know, telephone directories and put hoods on them. What type of physical evidence? Did they have a recording? Did they have a proof that he was involved with the Hamas organization?
The only evidence they really have is the fact that he did in 1993 bring money that was given for humanitarian and other charitable reasons. Now, if you may recall, in December of 1992, the U.S. Israeli government deported a large number of people who were believed to be Hamas members to Lebanon. They just, in the middle of the night, they just took them out of their homes and put them in Lebanon without any warning or any due process. And as a result of that, there were a lot of families suffering, and Mr. Salah was asked by humanitarian organizations here to go over there to distribute some money. So the evidence is that he did have money, that he did distribute the money, and the government and the Israeli government, and of course the U.S. government's working hand in hand with them, is saying that some of the money that he distributed was given to what they claim were leading members of Hamas. And essentially, the case is about that and his statements. And then, very interestingly, when he returned, you know, he did 5 years in prison already. You know, usually you say, well, you did your time, that's it. When he returned to this country, even at the airport, there was a group of people to greet him and welcome him home. In that group was an FBI informant. And that FBI informant befriended Mr. Salah and was with him almost every day for the next 7 years. And then the FBI informant's claiming that Mr. Salah sent him over to the occupied territories in 1999 to distribute some money to people. And he's a witness against Mr. Salah.
That's the voice of Michael Deutsch with the People's Law Office in Chicago, leading civil liberties and civil rights attorney in the United States, representing Mohammed Salah right now in his case. Michael, as Jamal and I listen to this, it's sending chills down our spine. And we're very concerned. Are you concerned about this?
Am I? Oh, absolutely. I'm outraged by it. I mean, you can't believe the effect of being in a courtroom where the courtroom is closed. They even put black covering on the windows of the courtroom, where the media is not allowed to come in, where his wife is not even allowed to come in. And then beyond that, when you ask a witness on the witness stand, well, did you tie him to a small chair? And the witness says, I won't answer that question. And the government, both the Israeli government and the U.S. government, who are both present in the courtroom, say that's classified, and they go in the back and discuss it in the back without you being there. It's 1984. It's Star Chamber. It's totally antithetical to everything that we believe is part of a democratic constitutional system.
And this is the democracy that they're bringing to Iraq right now. Michael, do you think that this is is this being targeted to one group or another? I mean, there are a lot of high-profile cases, the Sami Alayan case, the Mohamed Salah case. Is this being directed specifically at Palestinians and Palestinian Americans, do you think?
I think partially it is, of course, because we know that the U.S. government and the Israeli government have a very close relationship. And we know that if the Israeli government wants to deter support for the Palestinian people coming from the U.S., then the U.S. government is going to do its bidding. And that's essentially what this case is about. There was a lot of support from the Palestinian community in Chicago for the people living under occupation. There was money being raised. There was education going on.
And but the Jews do the same thing here, you know, for Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. It's totally selective and unfair. And that's because the Israeli government and the U.S. government are working hand in hand. And in fact, you have money being given to militant settler groups in the occupied territory, Israeli settler groups that use violence against Palestinians. That money's coming from the U.S., and there has never been any indictment against those money people, no charges, and the people who are being charged are the Palestinians.
To play just devil's advocate, have you heard of any similar cases? For example, when it comes, you know, what used to happen during the 60s and the 70s with the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, where they had cases here of alleged terrorists. Did we have similar kind of trials?
Yeah, there were a few cases in the 70s and early 80s of people who were charged with providing weapons and money for weapons for the IRA. There was a case I know in New York, and maybe one in San Francisco. There were some cases like that, but then those cases kind of died out, and now we're seeing particularly targeted people who are raising money through Muslim charities and who are supporting the Palestinians are being targeted. There was a case in Chicago, which kind of was a forerunner of the Salah case, where there was a civil lawsuit brought against a bunch of Palestinian organizations for raising money for the occupied territories, and they said that money was used for Hamas, and that Hamas took credit for killing a U.S. citizen, and that his family sued all these small organizations in the Chicago area and nationally, saying that because they raise money, that they were responsible for the death of this man. And a jury gave him $150 million in damages.
That's the voice of Michael Deutsch with the People's Law Office in Chicago, the lawyer and the attorney representing Mohamed Salah in this absolutely outrageous, bone-chilling case that's winding its way through the federal court system. Michael, we only have a few minutes left. I want to, first of all, you know, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we're going to have you back on Arab Talk. But what would you like to tell our listening audience who is listening not just in the Bay Area but all over the world? What message would you like to tell our audience? And secondly, what can people do if they want to do anything to support Mohamed's case right now?
Well, what I think people should do is the United States attorney who is prosecuting this case is Patrick Fitzgerald, and he is kind of a well-known person because he's also the special prosecutor of Scooter Libby and the Judith Miller and the lying to the grand jury affair. So he's a very well-known prosecutor and very well-known for allegedly prosecuting terrorist cases, and I think letters should be written to him demanding that the case against Mr. Salah and his co-defendant, Dr. Ashgar, be dismissed. And he can be written at 219 South Dearborn in Chicago, 60602. That's one thing that can be done. I think people have to be outraged and protest and not just say, well, this is, you know, business as usual. They should write their congressmen. They should be educated about what's going on in these so-called terrorism prosecutions, because all these things are obliterating our fundamental constitutional rights. And today it may be Palestinians, tomorrow it may be somebody else, and it could affect all of us. And we should not just, you know, pretend like it's business as usual.